You're listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast for corporate real estate and workplace leaders, where we talk about all things workplace and invite the people who are shaping the next generation of the office experience. I'm your host, Raphaël Morgulis, and my guest in this episode is Philip Ross. Philip is the founder and CEO of Unwired and Unwork, and the author of the book Unworking, The Reinvention of the Modern Office. Welcome to the Workplace Leader podcast. Today, I'm joined by Philip Ross. Considering that this is a podcast for people with a keen interest, at least for things related to the workplace and corporate real estate, I don't really think that Philip needs much introduction in theory, as he is probably one of the most recognizable figures in our industry. But still, it's my honor to have him with us today. And so I will definitely extend him the courtesy of introducing him. So Philip is an author, a futurist and advisor on the new world of work. And he specializes in predicting the impact that emerging technology will have on the way we work, shop, learn, consume leisure, and live. And Philip regularly gives keynotes, presentations, and runs think tanks and workshops for organizations that are in the process of change. He's also the founder of Unwork and leads the WorkTech events. And so again, it's a great pleasure for us to receive today someone with such a great, I would say, a privileged view on the world of work on our podcast. So thank you and welcome, Philip.
Thanks, Raphaël. Pleasure to be here.
So I already did a little bit of a setting the scene here in this introduction, but still I would ask you, like we do with all of our guests, to kind of describe you a little bit further. So what is your role? What is your background?
Sure. Look, it's great to be sharing some ideas. And it's a moment for workplace. I think we're in this kind of phenomenal inflection and we're trying to find answers. I started my journey 26 years ago. I'm an economist by training. I kind of began with a piece of research, really, to look at the office of the future back in the early 90s. And I almost stumbled across technology in the labs of Ericsson, Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, Toshiba, and others, which at the time was unheard of, and wrote a report called the Cordless Office Report, which I published myself in 1994. And launched the company on the back of that. And we made some very bold predictions. The office back then was static. It was tethered. People were cabled down with PCs and telephones on desks. And we said that's all going to be gone in a few years' time as portable technology and wireless connectivity challenged everything. People back then thought we were completely crazy. This was pre-Wi-Fi, pre-Bluetooth, pre-laptops, pre-smartphones, of course. But you know, over the years, it has gotten more and more interesting, and we think there's still a huge amount more to do. So that's been kind of the essence of how I founded the business. As you heard, I look at the kind of collision really between technology and physical space with a view as to how it changes how people use and behave in that physical space.
Thank you. And so you preside over, let's say, a number of different activities, right? And I wanted to ask you, let's say, for example, between your consultancy role, the more events, exchange of ideas role, what are the kind of common challenges that companies come to you for?
Well, look, I think the two are a little bit different. I started an events company mainly because I couldn't find any exciting events around the world. It was quite strange. And in the late 90s, I published one of my books called The Creative Office, which was a book that actually went into 11 languages. The premise of The Creative Office was that creative workspaces were no longer just the domain of creative companies. Every company had to have a creative workspace, and it just hit a nerve. And we talked a lot about the themes that we now take for granted. But people said to me, look, where can I hear more about this? And I was speaking at conferences which were very narrow, very siloed, you know, HR, technology, or facilities management. And so we came up with WorkTech, and we launched it with the British Library. It was 20 years ago. So back in 2003 was our first big WorkTech. And we attracted back then, it was a sellout crowd. And I remember one of our speakers was a slightly strange guy from Tallinn called Nicholas Zenstrom, who had founded this strange technology called Skype. And he said, I'm going to change the world. We're going to make phone calls free and it will be over data networks. And people thought he was completely bonkers. And we've always had really, really kind of cutting edge innovators and thought leaders, authors and practitioners. And I like the WorkTech brand. It's now in 41 cities. So an incredible global community, thousands of people all passionate about the future of work, but it brings together people from different backgrounds. We have technologists meeting HR practitioners, meeting real estate decision makers and corporate decision makers from COOs to CIOs. Alongside WorkTech, I founded Unwork as a innovation consultancy. So that really focuses on what's next, what's new, and helps build a business case for corporates to be bold and make change.
Well, thank you, because that segues perfectly into my next question. So you position your work in, let's say, the area that you find yourself and your company in as a being at the intersection between people, technology, and place. And I think while it is kind of accepted that these three things need to live together in synergy and harmony, it still seems to be the equation that everyone needs to find the answer to. And we still see a lot of projects, let's say in the day-to-day of organizations, projects and functions that work relatively isolated. It seems rare and it seems difficult, especially in large organizations, to see workplace HR and IT working truly hand in hand together and integrated. So the question here is, what does it take for an organization to work across these three elements holistically?
Gosh, Rafael, I mean, it depends on the size of the organization. You know, we work with some of the larger businesses in the world with hundreds of thousands of employees, so very complex. And at that level, far more difficult to integrate than a kind of maybe fintech or a startup or a scale-up type business. So I think each is different and each has different organizational structures. So it depends a little bit how those functions report up. Sometimes they go up to the board, sometimes they go up via finance, procurement, and so on. It's quite mixed. I think what we're beginning to see is a joined up approach. I think we're finding more and more of our workplace innovation projects are being led by HR people. So very much a people centric view of the world. And as we've discussed, the data is really interesting. I think for the first time ever, you can now combine data on people and performance with data on buildings and performance. And when you blend that together, the insights are remarkable. Anything from how you avoid burnout and mental health, so the idea of how you optimize buildings for both occupancy, sustainability, you know, waste reduction, all of those things come into play. So I think that anyone with a data-centric view of the world will succeed. And that data set needs to be looked at by different functions because it spans everything. So therefore, the decision makers, to my mind, often have to follow the data. And we're seeing the beginnings of chief experience officers, CXOs emerging, for example, because when it comes down to it, it's all about the experience you want to create for your people, your potential recruits, your clients, and so on. And as hybrid has challenged the working week, the kind of cadence of work, so it moves from kind of efficiency to what we call now super experience, which is much more about empathy than just about the kind of efficiencies of running real estate.
Thank you. And some of the evolutions or dynamics that you describe, a lot of those have, let's say, either been brought by or amplified by COVID-19. And so COVID-19, of course, beyond the, let's say, devastation that it has brought to too many people across the globe, it obviously has had a profound impact on the world of work, on the workplace. I think that's an understatement, since it wasn't that long ago that all the offices all of a sudden got completely empty. And then since then, it's been a very clearly never-ending discussion about the workplace in much larger circles, let's say, than just HR or corporate real estate or IT. Since we can mostly say that we're kind of out of the crisis side of it, would you say, since you have a very clear observatory point of view on the whole industry, would you now say that for workplace leaders, this crisis has been a net positive or a net negative disruption?
It's such an interesting question. What's the net? I mean, I think people still don't know the answer, Raphael. I think people are still struggling. You know, we had the great resignation, you know, what the Americans were calling the big quit a year ago, literally, because in effect, employees had the power and they were saying, you know, if you don't offer me flexible working, I'll go to the next company that does. And then, of course, the world has changed in the last 6 to 8 months. You know, we're tipping into recession. We've got energy crisis, war in Europe, inflation, interest rates going up. So very, very quickly, we've gone from the great quit, the big quit, to the great regret. You know, people thinking, actually, I made a mistake. And they're voting to be back in the office more regularly themselves because they don't want to be missed out in terms of promotion or projects. And they certainly don't want to be ignored in terms of redundancy. So it's a very interesting balance. So you can't just take historic data and say, let's right-size the office. Because as you go through economic cycles, people themselves want to change the patterns of behavior and the way they want to work. So I'm not sure that real estate's got it right yet. I still have been visiting offices that are empty. I mean, really low occupancy, 18%, 20% occupancy. So when you arrive in these big buildings, it's dead. It feels like a morgue. I mean, you can't see people. The people that are there are anonymous. You have no idea who they are. It's a very depressing experience. And at the same time, we are seeing other organizations reimagine what that workplace looks like. Less, in effect, desking, which is about solo work, the stuff that you can now do at home quite effectively, and much more about spaces to be together, and also amenity that drives being together, as opposed to kind of amenity that drives individual endeavor. I think we're still experimenting. If I take London, for example, we've been working on a building called 22 Bishopsgate. It's one of the smartest buildings now in the world, and it fully let just about in lockdown with some high quality clients. And why is that? Well, it's about a building reimagined for people. So I still think that workplace will drive, there'll be a flight to quality. I think there'll be a requirement for less space, but higher quality, both for the employee, but also for other metrics, whether it's sustainability or energy, etc.
It's interesting because you mentioned some very, very clear, let's say, directions or things that companies can do. At the same time, you mentioned the big regret, and that kind of evokes also a little bit of a hesitancy for people, but also organizations to dive into certain newer things head on, as can be kind of not menacing, but relatively scary. And that makes me think that your company is called Unwork, which is a very strong notion, right? And then your new book, Unworking, The Reinvention of Modern Office, also uses this notion. And I think it's a really pretty strong word to use, and I really like it because I think it's representative of kind of the magnitude of changes that are needed to adopt, but that people kind of are reluctant to go into, right?
Yes. Look, I mean, Raphael, we thought long and hard. I mean, the brand Unwork I came up with because I wanted to kind of show how much effort is needed to achieve innovation. I see so many projects kind of iterate. They look where they are, and they make some small adjustments, thinking that they're pushing forward the boundaries. And that typically involves just squeezing the footprint and sharing space. There's nothing imaginary about this. You know, you're just literally going from a workplace where people have their own desks or offices or cubes to a workplace that's a bit vanilla. You lose that sense of belonging, and it becomes quite anonymous and unloved. And you may gain a few kind of, you know, they call it soft seating areas, you know, a few unloved bits of sofa and the odd cafe. That's not really the answer. I think to get to a truly innovative workplace, you have to unbundle your assumptions. You have to unlearn the behaviors that you've assumed are right. And I think that unbundling, that unlearning is what Unworking is all about. Unraveling where we've been and starting again, in effect. And so the Unwork philosophy is exactly that. It's taking a blank sheet of paper and building the case for what you want for work from the ground up, with no assumptions. And the Unworking book, which you referenced, which we've just published, talks a lot about not just the kind of direction of travel, but bases it on evidence as to where we've come from and some of the major influences that we think are reshaping everything from diversity and talent to data and technology, and these forces which are unstoppable but offer huge opportunity for corporates to do something different.
And speaking of unlearning old habits, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a provocative question. What's the one most egregious thing that you still see companies do that you think, okay, we're in 2022, we cannot really do that anymore?
There are so many. I mean, I've spent a lot of time recently actually going back into offices around the globe. Yeah, where to start, right? Because I think so much lip service is paid to some of these things. What really frustrates me is that offices now feel like a furniture showroom. You walk into a space and they say, oh, we've got all this new stuff. We've got phone booths because people want private work. And these, it's not the solution. I think that there are much more considered approaches to how we create workspace, which is a truly exciting space to go to, that's scaled for the work that people are really trying to undertake. but that more and more provokes you or nudges you. I think we need to move towards AI and machine learning so that we're not kind of just guessing and using history, but we're using AI, which is the tool of the future, right, to help people manage their work day, their work week. And I think that's the exciting opportunity. So almost what I would suggest is people need to adopt data science. And we have this theme that I talk about called the science of work. And I would suggest that actually the most exciting avenue for evolution is to kind of almost become data scientists in workplace, to design and constantly refine, almost being in perpetual beta as an idea for workplace, and avoid this pretty grim approach of bringing in a design firm or space planning organization and just bringing furniture in as being the solution for all of our worries.
It's great that you mentioned that because, A, on one side, it makes me think, so we also invested at Locati on having a data science team, but it's not just to deliver some insights to our customers, it's also to work with our customers to kind of co-create the understanding or what can the data be used for. So that's one thing that's really interesting. The other thing I wanted to answer on, you mentioned the pretty furniture, right? But I think I was talking to a previous guest around, it can be good, but it has to be tied to, let's say, strategies and bigger objectives. It has to be linked to some sort of company, larger purpose. And so, and that can be the answer. So same as at some point, perks in the office were kind of derided as, nah, it's not a solution. It's not something that will help you. Or it can be if it's linked to something actually purposeful, but kind of intention, that's the important thing.
I totally agree. I mean, I think those are two very valuable words. I think purposeful and intentionality have come through quite strongly, that we like the idea of magnetizing people to want to come in, as opposed to mandating, which is the Elon Musk view of the world. We were calling them Muscovites the other day, which I think is quite a nice term for those kind of organizations which are kind of trying to bang the drum and make you come in for no apparent reason. I think if you look at how you magnetize people to want to come in and how you shape an experience, that's a very exciting place to be. And I think you don't want to leave experience to chance. You want to say, look, what's the optimal experience we would like people to have? How do we generate this idea I mentioned earlier, super experience? Once you identify an experience map, which should be steeped in design thinking and an approach which is user-centric, you look at all the touch points, all the moments of truth, and they're the ingredients that I think are crucial for the success in the future.
Yes, and I think that's where technology and data, it's still in a process of maturing towards giving that, let's say, material for the design to be effective. So for example, if you're going to be thinking about tailoring an experience which is much more closer to certain individual needs, you obviously cannot create an experience that's completely individualized. That's impossible. But at the same time, if you work together with the technology providers and the data people to create, for example, personas, profiles, that can give you the kind of, okay, we have 4, 5, 6 different types of experience that we can try to provide in the office.
I probably disagree with you then. I think you can personalize experience. And I think that's the kind of, that's the aim, right? We could get it right down because we're all carrying a cell phone, a mobile phone, right? And that is the gateway to personalization of experience. We both know, Raphael, there's been a gold rush to the idea of a workplace app that shapes your experience. And that's about who you are. So the way that technology is moving, we think that you can personalize experience down to the individual because the cell phone knows who you are and where you are. And if you get the technology inside a building right, so for example, you can have in-building navigation using location technology. So for those that are designing new workspaces, you know, you can get location-aware layers in buildings through technologies like Wi-Fi with triangulation or Bluetooth with beaconing. And that lets the individual know where he or she is to wayfind or where their colleagues are or where the nearest whatever might be or how to navigate down to the salad bar. All of these things can be achieved, which give you this idea of super experience. And I think one of the things we're passionate about is most organizations have diversity as a corporate value. And they talk about it because they want to attract diverse people for the benefits of their diverse background and diverse approach. But they then shut out diversity at the front door of the office and create a one-size-fits-all environment. They shoehorn people into the same space, the same desk, the same lighting, the same noise levels. That kills diversity. So when you look at things like neurodiversity, when you look at cognitive diversity, we think that we could celebrate that in the workplace by providing true choice and the ability for people to be kind of able to personalize and adapt and choose the space that suits them based on what they're trying to do and who they are, etc. That offers us a brave new world of exciting possibilities, we think.
I really like that because it speaks to me from personal level, because so I often describe myself as an introvert. And so becoming an introvert, a leader as an introvert in the workplace is quite difficult, because the workplace has been created for a one-size-fits-all types of leadership, which is the extremely charismatic, extroverted leader, right? And so that's a very interesting thought. It's like, how do we create a workplace that is actually fitting different types of functioning, of organizational models, of types of leaderships? That's really interesting.
It's great, isn't it? I think it's an opportunity. And again, in the book, in Unworking, we talk a bit about some of the work from McKinsey and others around the power of cognitive diversity to leadership groups. And for example, I would suggest that actually in an organization, rather than leaders being scattered around the building and having to go spend endless hours in meetings, you know, boardrooms and so on, why not create a leadership hub, which some organizations like AB InBev have been famous by doing? So leaders kind of sit together by default, and then you get the decision making and the speed that we need in the current way of doing business and the current economic climate. So I think, again, the workplace can be a catalyst for new behaviors and fast company behaviors, especially.
So we've been talking about quite a few of these possible directions for changing the workplace. What do you think will be the defining trend in 2023 for corporate real estate, for workplace, for designing the workplace experience?
Well, I think maybe we split that into two, Raphael. I think for those organizations where there's a lease event, where they can exercise a break or there's an end of lease and they can reimagine what they need, it's a huge opportunity to kind of reduce real estate. So I predict a 30, 40% reduction in real estate, which for many on the bottom line has a massive impact. So there's a moment there to reimagine what you need. For those companies stuck in longer leases, to my mind, the approach there is about reimagining and reinventing and using data as your tool to kind of think about what people really need when they're coming in. And there's some great examples of buildings that have now been, during COVID and post-lockdown, kind of reinvented for that kind of new world of work with hybrid. One of the key things that we need to get right, for example, is digital equity. We are going to be in a situation going forwards where not everyone will be in the room. And that could be quite good for neurodiverse individuals. But the people who are remote still have a second-class experience. So all of our meeting rooms are inappropriate for hybrid and digital equity. Why do we have rooms that are rectangular? In the book, in Unworking, we discussed the geometry of the circle. And yet all of our meeting rooms are rectangular with a screen at the end, which is a terrible format for digital equity. So we need to reimagine. There are obviously new AI cameras coming out from Huddly and Neat and others that will have two or three cameras in the room and powered by AI. So the remote participants get a much better experience. So even just getting, for those that haven't got the ability to move, a more effective workplace and a reimagined experience for people that builds on what we have to try and achieve, that would be the goal, I would suggest.
That's fascinating, because what you describe, especially thinking about the let's say more rounded meeting room, that calls an entire process into question, right? It's not just what's the material that's in the room, but it's also all the way up to the upstream to the actual design of the building, I guess.
Exactly that. And I think that's key, right? So, you know, we want to design buildings with fresh air, with outdoor space, with biophilia, with great daylight. That, I think, post-pandemic will be more and more sought after. We want buildings that are energy efficient, that maybe generate their own energy and have a DC power grid to stop the waste of transformers and stepping down. We want to have buildings that let you walk and not take the lift and elevator, so they're encouraging health and well-being. We want to have buildings that are rich in amenity and also buildings that are activated. So when you arrive at the lobby, there's energy, there's buzz, there's vibrancy. There's the term I'm using now is earn the commute. You know, you want to make sure that people feel that they've justified both the time and cost to get to an office.
I also want to come back to the first point you mentioned, because it's pretty clear. We are seeing this as well on the market, that there is a clear intention to reduce. But in a way, this calls back some, let's say, previous objectives or priorities from the corporate real estate function. And we had seen in the last few years, let's say, a kind of balancing of objectives where it used to be that the financial part of corporate real estate was definitely the most important part of it. And then progressively, the workplace experience, for example, was becoming more and more of an equal side of the workplace equation. And now it seems that maybe again, the priority is on cost. And it's, of course, tied to the context, et cetera, et cetera. But how do we know, or do we have some sort of hope that even if the function is going to be financially driven again, it won't necessarily go towards the very productivity detrimental results of decades past?
You know, one hopes we've moved on. And I think to me, what's important is that there are a number of forces at play. You know, cost is one. It varies, but you know, you want to kind of obviously attract a Gen Z cohort. For them, there are new values. They want to see the sharing economy. They want to see sustainability and a range of other things like reduction in food waste is important for them. So I think there are so many different criteria that should be kind of put forward as part of the strategy going forwards. But of course, we're in recession, or we're heading to recession, and therefore cost reduction is a given. Real estate is the second largest overhead after salaries. And not only can you reduce that real estate cost very directly because of what we've talked about, but also there's a very cool and very direct correlation between physical space and people and their performance, which is the biggest cost for most organizations. So if you leverage productivity through the reimagining of how we work, you then, of course, you know, pivot to a place where your human resources are more effective and your real estate resources are more effective. So I think there's a kind of optimization and a reduction that we need to look at.
And if we're thinking about workplace leaders, the expansion of the different worries or concerns or objectives and challenges that they have to take on, I can imagine has created a little bit of an anxiety when it comes to the number of skills that one has to now be able to understand, right? And I remember being in marketing only a decade ago when everything was becoming digital and it became this incredible maelstrom of new concepts, new skills to learn in order to be relevant in our function. I can imagine in the workplace function, it's a little bit happening right now. So in order to bring things in a little bit of a more tangible way, what would you say you see as the kind of common trait, most important trait or skill or element that is important for workplace leaders to have today?
That's a very interesting question, Rafael. I think I'll pick technology. I think what's interesting for me is if I rewind the clock to when I started in workplace, I did quite a lot of talking and work with facility management, and they had quite an important role. They were responsible for overhead projectors and carousel projectors, slide projectors. Remember those things with the carousels? You're probably too young. But anyway, when I used to present to begin with, this is pre-laptops, you had a carousel full of slides, you popped on a projector, they clipped in. That was audiovisual, and the FM was responsible for that. The FM was responsible for photocopiers, which were those big machines around the office. And my point is that slowly, all of these things are now the domain of technology. Everything that the FM used to be responsible for, which is the kind of workplace world, is now online, digital, and connected. And the next wave will be even more extreme. Every vending machine will be online. All security access control. And then, of course, things like cleaning and security will become robotic. There'll be automation. So there's a lot of technology that will transform the world of workplace, both the operational side, the strategy, and the design side as well. The use of AI and algorithms, there's so much there. So I would say the answer to that question is, I think digital workplace would be the skill set that is most needed. And we predict a range of things. I mean, the idea of a digital twin, we think, is fundamental to the future of workplace. And we'll have digital twins for most people and ideas in life. Even our own human beings will be twinned for medical reasons. But certainly workplace will get twinned. There'll be some workplace leaders that get that and others that just don't understand what technology means for their world.
Thank you. And then you have been seeing a lot of, let's say, projects, or I've participated and collaborated on a lot of different experimental projects. So what is the most creative project or experiment that you have participated or witnessed so far in your career?
Yeah, so that's great. I mean, I've been fortunate over those 26 years of running my own business to work for some amazing clients, inspirational people. Very difficult to pick one or two because there've been so many. Let me pick one from Australia, because one of the first major projects we did in Australia was for Macquarie. We were working with them on a building they had near Darling Harbour called Chelly Street, and it became the first activity-based workplace in Australia. Started the idea of activity-based working in that part of the world, but also in that sector, and that's cascaded. And I think what was exciting about that project is that they were approaching it from a very traditional perspective. It was going to be many, many desks, everyone with their own desk, the usual approach to workplace. But the team they pulled together and the leadership were open to challenge. And I think the end result was fabulous. You know, the design by Clive Wilkinson, the technology that was adopted, just the whole thing became an exemplary example. And then if I look at America, let me pick, I've got some amazing projects at the moment, but probably too early to talk about them. But the one I loved more recently was Boston Consulting Group. They moved from Park Avenue to Hudson Yards. It was a moment to reimagine what they wanted. And again, in New York, it was normally very traditional workspace. BCG went for a radical workspace. Again, reclustered by industry sector, anchored it with an incredible cafe called the Highline Cafe, cascaded this incredible staircase across their six floors to kind of encourage what we call the collision coefficient. Because, of course, the purpose of a workplace is about people and the ideas and the collisions and the serendipity, and not just a kind of a container for desks, cubes, and rooms. And then in the UK, there have been so many. Gosh, hard to pick one, but I think I will choose 22 Bishopsgate. I think Stuart Lipton is a great developer, very forward-looking pioneer in real estate and workspace. And the thing that I loved at 22 Bishopsgate is we challenged the lobby experience, and the idea that you come into a lobby and you queue up at a desk and get a badge and a lanyard and you wait around and it's all gone. And the lobby now looks like a hotel. There are no desks for reception. There are no security desks. If you're coming in for a meeting, you get a boarding pass to your mobile phone. You scan in at the gates. You're straight up to the floor. It's an airline travel experience. And of course, it allows us to reimagine the lobby and reimagine what we want to shape as experience. So I picked three interesting examples from different parts of the world. But like all these things, there are so many exciting clients, exciting projects, and people doing brave things. I think you need a brave client to push the boundaries, because like all these things, innovation's never easy.
Those are great examples, and it leads me to a follow-up here. Just like in other areas, so for example, I'm thinking of music or fashion, you need these avant-garde projects, very adventurous people that kind of push the boundaries. And then slowly but surely, it trickles down to more the mainstream, right? And I guess it's the same when it comes to the workplace. You will have these very, very high-end examples. And then at some point, of course, at the beginning, it's not relevant for the whole portfolio of a massive company organization that has 500, 600 buildings. But at some point, this trickles down to the whole experience, right? How long does it take? Is that accelerating as well?
Look, I think it has to accelerate. I think that people move fast and break things is the kind of mantra of the tech firms in the Valley. I think, you know, fail fast is important. I think that first mover advantage is interesting. Not many companies want to be first mover, but they want to be fast followers. So I think, again, you know, once people have been brave, once they've seen benefits, either cost reduction and therefore competitive advantage or better talent attraction and retention or whatever the measure is, you'll get this kind of trickle down and a rush to kind of catch up.
So thanks a lot for this great conversation. I want to finish with the last question. Who should we reach out next as our next podcast guest?
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting. I think, Raphael, like you, I mean, especially during lockdown, I was interviewing a lot of interesting people. I think we are surrounded by people with really great ideas. And at WorkTech, I always sit back and think, well, who's done the thinking? Where are the great thinkers? And, you know, from history, my favorites like Charles Handy, the management author, or Edward de Bono, who came up with the colored hats, or Alain de Botton, the philosopher who talks about the future of work and happiness. They're all great people to think about. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. But I think one person that I think you should definitely interview and talk to, who's slightly left field, so I thought that might be interesting, is Stanley McChrystal. I don't know whether you've met Stanley. He was a five-star general. He was a General McChrystal. He commanded the U.S. armed forces in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, and he led the hunt for al-Qaeda in Iraq. So slightly divorced from workplace, right? You might think, well, why am I suggesting a five-star general to talk about workplace? But he, in Balad, in Baghdad, just outside Baghdad, built himself a command center, which is a workplace, in a huge hangar. And he created a place where everybody could work together and where everything was visualized. And he told me that whereas in most military campaigns, the walls are covered with maps, in his command center, the walls were covered in whiteboards with interesting concepts and a lot of digital technology to bring in people with video and so on. So his approach was different, but more importantly, he reimagined the organization. He went from the org chart of command and control to the idea of fluid teams. And he's written a book called Team of Teams to reflect his experience. And I think we should learn from that. Frederick Taylor, who came up with the org chart and the idea of the office and structure, also came up for the military with the structure. And we're now challenging that across the board. And the idea of fluid teams being accommodated, to me, is a big part of the future. And I thought that what Stanley himself did as a leader and how he wrote about it and how he used analogies back to workplace, you'd be fascinated with a conversation. And also, his backdrop is much more impressive than mine. The military paraphernalia and photographs on his wall is exceptional. So you'll enjoy that as well. So there's my recommendation.
That is an amazing recommendation. Thank you so much. I always like a left field recommendation, but this one in particular was pretty great. So thanks a lot, Philip, again, for joining us. This has been a really, really, really passionate discussion. And so we'll see you soon at one of the WorkTech events. I'm sure your audience will do as well. And so thank you so much.
Raphael, it's been a real pleasure. And for those that are listening, if you can give me some feedback when I'm working, if you read the book, I would love it. Like all these things, it's about trying to share ideas and generate some thoughts for the future. So any dialogue, any interaction would be great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, my colleague Michelle joins me to discuss some elements that inspired her from the conversation with Philip. We both take the point of view of end users from different generations, observing what is happening in the world of workplace.
2 years ago, almost 3 years ago, COVID started and left us in total disarray of what we're supposed to do at work. And we ended up doing a lot of home office naturally because that seemed reasonable at the time. And that led us to wondering if people actually need to be at the office ever at all. Cue hybrid work, cue remote work. We saw a lot of different approaches to this. We saw people bringing others into the office for like 1 day a week, maybe half days sometimes. They were dividing it between teams to try and get less people in. And eventually, a lot of these companies said, we don't need to have people at the office at all. The work is still getting done, even though we've been remote for most of this time. But now we're seeing the opposite effect, where we're trying to bring people back into the office. And that looks very different for different companies. That can be mandating 1 day a week, which is a pretty tame approach. On the other hand, we've gotten big companies threatening, maybe you could say, that their employees need to come in 5 days a week, you know, full time again, more than full time. That was making me wonder if that's actually the right thing to do or if it's the wrong thing to do. I mean, we have a lot of opinions going around, very many hot takes. Basically, this affects every single person who is employed by somebody to some extent, because even if my own company isn't telling me that I have to come in the office, it makes me wonder, are they going to tell me suddenly one day that they expect me back on Monday and I have no choice or else I lose my job? And how would I feel about that? So are they actually wrong to be doing this? Is a completely different matter because I have my preferences, but does that mean actually that people who are requesting that their employees come in are doing the incorrect thing? Maybe they're doing the right thing. What do you think?
I would try to think about this not from the employee's perspective, which is something that we naturally tend to do. And I think when we're thinking about, let's say, the larger conversation, conferences about the workplace or on LinkedIn, for example, a lot of it is point of views that kind of espouse the point of view of the employees. And actually, we don't really take the view of the leader, the one who takes that decision. And I think we tend to be very easily judging these types of decisions because we don't really have to take them. We're never in that position, right? But let's say, hypothetically, let's say I'm the CEO. And basically, what people under me are telling me is something like this, and I'm going to be simplifying on purpose, but okay, there's a diversity of needs, there's a diversity of expectations, of functional roles and needs for the office. And then when it comes to implementation, well, we cannot really do it too personalized because it's super difficult to implement, and that would be a complete operational nightmare. Plus, we believe, and we know also from quite a few studies, that having people together, at least on a regular basis, is better for a lot of different reasons. We think that it creates better meetings, or that it leads to better creativity, and that people network internally, and there's more development, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we also have to be careful about diversity and favoritism and things of that nature, and also, and so on and so on. And if I'm the CEO here and I listen to this, I would already be like, hey, you know what? If you're not going to give me a clear way forward, I still have to take a decision, and I cannot take this tomorrow. I'm taking it today because that's what is expected of me from various different stakeholders, not just the employees. And you know, in that case, I have to take the decision now, and I will revert to what sounds safe to me, which is what we had before, or some sort of version of it that is relatively close by. So, you know, come to me when you have a better idea, maybe, but that is going to be the decision. Thanks, and next topic. And I think if we start looking at it this way, I actually understand that. You need a decision now, and not whenever we know this stuff well enough. I'm not necessarily agreeing, not the intention, but the content behind a mandate, but I can see why that's maybe the best decision at that time.
It's really great that you bring it up from a topic or from the perspective of a leader, because the entire reason that I brought the question up in the first place when I mentioned it to you was because I was scrolling on LinkedIn one day, right after our good buddy Elon Musk told all his employees, I think it was at Twitter, that they must come into the office, and they're expected to be at the office more than the average employee anywhere else might be. And if they don't like that, then they can leave. Again, from my perspective, I panicked and said, no, please don't let this happen at my office. I do not want to be at the office every single day. No, thank you. But the person who was talking about it on LinkedIn was explaining that from her perspective, Elon was being a leader, and that's what his job was. And sometimes that is an opinion or taking a stance that's not favorable or not well-liked by everyone else. And it doesn't really matter if people like it or not, because his job as the person pushing the company forward is to make these decisions, exactly as you say. And I have to say that that was the first time I stepped back and admittedly thought, you know what, this person has a very good point.
I think that's the thing about trying to put yourself in the shoes of the leader, because that changes the perspective. Now, what I will say about what's wrong about mandates, it's not necessarily the mandate itself, but it's how they're communicated and framed. So if you're going to say, for example, we are mandating you back in the office because we think that you're more productive in the office, then that's incredibly wrong. Because productivity is not defined by where you are in itself. It's by many different factors. The activities you need to perform, the adequation of your context to these activities, then the space, but also your energy level, your stress and anxiety levels, the availability of the right resources for you to carry out these activities, and so on and so forth. And so to say point blank, yeah, productivity is better at the office, that's oversimplifying, and your people won't buy that one second, because there's just not really much data or experience and intuition that proves this point. And actually, on the opposite side of things, there's the experience of the lockdowns that proved that productivity was feasible, at least from a perception point of view from the employees. They perceive themselves as being productive, whether you like it or not, whether you agree or not. That's just a fact. And so you're going to be going against that perception. And I think what's important then is to frame it in the right way. So if you frame the mandate differently and you say something like, hey, you know, at the moment, with our current capabilities as an organization, with our current understanding and capacity to address the challenges of providing every single individual employee with an amazing experience that's fully adequate in driving their best work, with this current knowledge of ours as an organization, that's the best we can do. And we just don't know better. I, as a leader, don't necessarily know better. But I have to take decisions as a leader. That's what I have to do. And I believe that this is the best decision for us right now. And while this is the decision I take today, I can also commit to working on our organization's capacity to address this with maybe more capacity, more maturity. But it will be a process. And what I can commit to is that we will communicate about that throughout. And I think if you take it from that kind of point of view, it's understandable. It's something that you can receive. It's something also that you can see as maybe more genuine. And it goes a lot towards the myth or the legend of the leader having all the answers and knowing everything. In that case, that's just not true. We don't necessarily know. We don't have the experience. We just faced this pandemic. So with a lack of perfect answers, we need to take a decision nonetheless. And that, I think people can understand it.
That is a very, very good point. Because I think a lot of the things that freak people out is how so many of these companies communicated it. Oftentimes at the last second, hey, 3 days from now, you're here full time. I don't care if you live somewhere else. I don't care if you have to commute an hour and a half each way. That's your problem and deal with it now because we're doing this whether you like it or not. And I think that also became an issue for so many people where they felt like they didn't matter like at all because it was their employer just deciding for the entire company at once what they will do. But on the other hand, like communication or not, doesn't a CEO, a founder of a company get to decide what kind of a company they want to build? I don't think that a lot of people had a lot of stress about GitHub becoming a fully remote company. If they wanted to do that, that's okay. Like, I wasn't sitting here thinking, wow, how dare they build a fully remote company while I come to the office every day. On the flip side, now that I'm working remotely, why can't Elon say that he wants to build a company that is 100% in office? And I don't think there's going to be a shortage of people wanting to work under him. Whether or not he decides that, I think people will look at the other benefits and decide for themselves. And maybe he won't each time get the very, very, very best engineer, but is the like 500th best engineer in the world not good enough for what he wants to accomplish? Probably they are.
Yeah, but I think what you said early on, that's the message, right? When a leader says, you come to the office 5 days a week and I don't care if you like it or not. I mean, that's pretty much the message that is being sent, even if it might be said a different way. What you're basically conveying as a message is, we didn't take into consideration your needs, your individuality, etc. We didn't even go there. Whereas maybe if you, and that might not even be representative of the efforts of the company, of the organization, that might be even misconveying what has happened, for example, from the HR department or the workplace department, because they might have actually tried to come up with a solution. But if you said something along the lines of, we have looked into it, we have tried to accommodate, and what we can do or cannot do at the moment is this, because X, Y, Z reasons, because we have too many roles that we feel and we consider that they have to be in the office in order to be functioning. We have too many diverse situations, or I don't know how to describe all the dimensions possible. It is complex. We've looked at how to address that and we don't have a better answer. We have to admit that this is the state of the process for us. At least you're communicating that you did consider and yet you did care, but you arrived at this decision that might be adverse to, against what the employee's individual wants are. But at least you tried. And I think that's sometimes what we kind of expect.
I mean, I think we've said it enough times on this podcast that a company relies on its employees. And I think that's true. And that's one of the reasons that we believe that a company should look at what its employees' needs are and how they can work with them to create the best working environment, the best workplace. But in the end, I guess there is no right or wrong. All we will see is how it turns out for these companies in the end, right? And maybe we're the crazy ones and actually we're wrong. Maybe leaders should just point blank make a decision and stick with it. But in my opinion, probably that's not going to be the case. And I think the ones that are going to come out on top are going to be the ones that have at least found a bit of flexibility in the way they do things. But who knows? Let's see what happens to Twitter 3 years from now. And then I guess we'll have the chance to actually form an opinion on what decisions Elon has made. This is the first time in history that we know of, that we clearly see four generations working together under one often metaphorical roof. We have baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, and Gen Zs coming together for the first time, bringing basically 70 or so years of information to one place. How do we accommodate for all of that? And what steps do we need to take in order to make all of them feel heard and seen?
That is where I actually end up leaning towards some sort of constrained hybrid model. This is going to be kind of almost off topic, but I do tend to think of, you know, 2, 3, or 4 day mandates. Me as an individual, I find that artificial. So if you say you need to be in the office 3 days a week, I receive it as very artificial, especially if there's only a vague justification for it. And we talked about communication earlier. If the justification for that mandate is we want collaboration and it's actually not followed by concrete actions to foster that collaboration, and I can actually end up going the 3 days at the office and not do anything differently than what I do at home, you know, then the thing is, it becomes a case of comparing the office and home. That's wrong for the, let's say, 3 day mandate. But if there's a clear intention in corresponding actions, then it changes things. And for example, if we would say we want people to be in the office 2 days a week, and one of these days has to be a Wednesday, and we want that because we believe that there is a need for and a benefit of personal interactions. We believe that collaboration and bonding is stronger when it's done in person. And finally, we believe that expanding internal networks is mutually beneficial for the company as well as for you as an employee in your development. And that goes with mixing up generations, for example, and making sure that the knowledge of the older generations get passed on, et cetera, et cetera. And not only is our decision to mandate these 2 days rooted in these core beliefs, we will also organize a number of activities on these Wednesdays to foster the outcomes that we just described. And I think that's how you do it, because you don't just have four generations. You also have so many different functions, so many different personality types, so many different walks of life and choices of life that it's impossible to accommodate everyone's individual needs all the time. But the thing is, I think people don't necessarily reject the constraints just because they are constraints. And actually, all of our adult lives are basically taking on more constraints as we grow because we see a benefit and a value at the end, right? So you don't take a mortgage just because it's fun. You actually see a value at the end. And so we don't reject the ones that we understand. We reject the ones that we don't understand. And so, again, it's very much about communicating the purpose and intentions. And that's where, to come back to the original questions, how do we accommodate all that? Well, I think that's where hybrid, kind of constrained hybrid models make sense, because then you are going to engineer the connection between these generations, but you cannot just do it by edicting that mandate, you also need to follow up with a certain number of activities and actions to make sure that you're not just four generations under a space roof, but you also then start sharing and you actually collaborate together. And that doesn't happen magically. You need much more than just a space in order for this to happen.
It's a really good point. I just had to laugh when you were saying that, you know, all these companies who are trying to say, yes, we want collaboration. That's why we're bringing you back into the office. And they bring you back into the office, the same old office. Nothing's changed. Nothing's different. We don't see new meeting rooms. We don't see any workshop spaces. We don't even see little stools set out anywhere so that we can actually sit down with the people that we're supposedly collaborating with. Everyone's getting back on their computer to take video calls. How has anything changed, right? It just reminded me when you were explaining that how ridiculous this can become if we aren't thinking these things through. But as far as the generations go, I totally hear what you're saying, that we need to somehow find the ways to collaborate. But I think a challenge of having so many different generations is that oftentimes people from different generations have the tendency to believe that the way that their generation does it is the best. And I'm not saying one generation more than the other, because I don't think that's the case. I think we see, for example, Gen Xers, that they were raised in the office and they were coming in every day, but are happy with their families to go home and spend some time there. And so they're okay with hybrid. On the other hand, we see Gen Zers who believe in this hybrid model because they're tech savvy, they get it, but they need the support from mentors to help them develop in their careers. And on one hand, it seems so simple that maybe Gen Xers want to be in the office because that's what they're used to. But on the other hand, they live a different reality. And so for them, it's easier to step away from the office and spend time at home because they've been doing this for 20 years and they're used to it. And they're a little bit more flexible in the help that they need. But Gen Zers don't have that. And how do these generations come together to work, actually collaborate together genuinely and move forward in a way that helps everybody?
I think that's a typical case of framing things around psychological safety. And the reason I say that is that if I think, for example, about what you mentioned at the onset of the argument, which is, yeah, a certain generation will say that they were doing this better, or this new generation thinks they're doing things faster, etc. A lot of this kind of underlying criticism is really a protection mechanism. It's rooted in the fact that, for example, if you're part of the older generation, so for example, the baby boomers that are still working, or the Gen Xers who might feel threatened because they have less, they are not digital natives, and they have more trouble adapting maybe to some very, very fast innovation that come every year pretty much, and they feel threatened in their relevancy at work. So they, you know, if they feel this threat, and if companies and society in general doesn't make them feel safer in their usefulness and their value at work, providing, for example, guidance and mentorship, then there's going to be this attitude of protection. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have maybe the newer generation who are maybe insecure because they are feeling like the older generation are kind of hoarding all the power and not letting go and not empowering the younger generations. And they feel quite frustrated about this, etc. And that's also related to psychological safety. You need to provide the newer generation with a more positive outlook for what is going to be given to them and how they are going to be empowered, etc., etc. And then it creates all these discourses around, this newer generation, they are so entitled, etc. It's actually more of a protection mechanism. And I think that's a very bigger picture discussion, where is society actually inclusive enough in order for everyone to feel safe in their identity and what they bring? And then if you have this psychologically safe environment, then there is more curiosity to understand what the others can bring to you and what you can bring to them versus what they will take away from you and what you have to protect from them. And I think that's a very deep, let's say, thought or challenge more at the society level?
That's a really interesting point, because I don't know if I've ever heard it positioned that way, that the best way to approach the differences in the generations is from a perspective of psychological safety, but that it would be so valuable to show people that you understand their concerns and their needs. But how do we actually manufacture that on a day-to-day basis in the office?
That's a really good question, but I think that comes down to, I think we talked a lot recently in the workplace environment about the synergies and the need for different functions that are part of the workplace equation to work together. And that's typically here you're talking about workplace and corporate real estate and HR, because this is typically an HR topic and discussion to say, if you are arriving at 50, 55, 60 and plus, you shouldn't feel the stress of, will I be still relevant? Will I still have opportunities? If I was to lose my job, how difficult will it be for me to find something again? Because if you feel these stress and anxieties, of course, it's going to completely taint your attitude towards other generations, because you're going to feel like you're going to be replaced and become obsolete. And that's for HR to kind of provide the framework for older generations to say, no, we will still value your contributions and we will make sure that there is a path for you that might not be a path towards, you know, growing up in the hierarchy, but that, yeah, that will still be of use to of the company and the organization. Yeah.
Yes. And I think it also could be a helpful approach also for newer generations. This idea that HR takes it into their hands to help provide mentorship opportunities, the things that Gen Zers are missing. Yes, that they can provide them these opportunities, help them find ways to gain mentorship. That's what truly it seems like many of the people coming into the workforce now are missing, is the chance to learn from other people. But it doesn't have to be at the office. That's not the only way to sit beside somebody and hear them talk about a marketing plan, for example. That's not the only way to learn. There are much more direct and hands-on ways even. Maybe it's as simple as implementing programs that maybe not specifically target generational gaps, but approach some of the issues that these generations are likely to be having. So maybe for older generations, it would mean reskilling, developing new skills, opportunities to do these things where they can learn something in digital media if they haven't had the chance to already. And on the flip side, opportunities for, yeah, these younger generations to gain mentorship, to learn more of the ground, like the foundations of the skills that they're trying to develop, to learn foundations of different skills that maybe they don't yet need. But that's really what you're getting when you're in a vibrant and great office. You're getting to learn from different people. And I don't think that has to be only spontaneous. It can be scheduled.
Absolutely. And I think there are some clear topics, for example, where older generations could provide their experience, having lived through most likely everything that we go through has been lived again and again multiple times by the people that have been working for 20, 30, 40 years. And so what is going to be new for us, there is going to be someone in the organization that can tell you, hey, actually, I've done that. I've done that three times, or I've done that four times. You know, I've gone through a recession, or I've gone through a change of leadership, or I've gone through a reorganization, or whatever else that there is. I mean, if you have been working for 40 years, you've probably lived that a number of times. And then you might not say, this is what's going to happen, but you can say, okay, this is how I reacted. And so this is what you may be attentive to, because you personally, you're going to have these fears, or you're going to have these triggers, or you're going to have these and these and these behaviors, and you might want to be attentive to that. That's really interesting, because of course, yes, this can be scheduled. Absolutely. Thanks for listening. We will soon be back for more. And in the meantime, go visit our blog at locati.com and have a look at the other topics we have covered, or stay tuned for more episodes of The Workplace Leader.